This is the Creative Sports Podcast.
My name is Justin Peterson, and joining me are Brock Rahm.
I try to have gear from all my clients.
And Karina Anglada.
I got my mechanical pencil that I'm waving right now.
How would you like to wear your own work? What about seeing other people sport work that you've created? Brian Gundell sees random people wearing his designs all the time. It's one of the cool parts of his gig as the manager of graphic design NHL jerseys at Fanatics. Covering his time early in sports, we dive into his process, freelance life, and his strong opinion on AI's impact in the world of sports design. You want to call the time, Brock?
Sure. Let's go 52. That was pretty good on my end, at least.
That was spot on.
Do you have an interest in adding motion design to your skill set, but just aren't sure where to start?
Let's go!
Welcome to Baller Effects, your source for sports content and motion tutorials. From tips and tricks to long-form tutorials and project deep dives, there's a lot to take in. There's even a free mini-course playlist called How to Animate Sports for Social. This playlist will take you step-by-step through the process of creating a 5-second animated player stat graphic. For your sport-specific motion training, visit BallerFX on YouTube and get started today. Today we have Brian Gundell joining us here. He's the graphic design manager of NHL jerseys at Fanatics, but has spent some time in college and with Nike, with Old Hat, and got a start at the University of Oregon, went to school out in the Pacific Northwest. So excited to talk to you today, Brian, and hear a little bit more about your journey and creating logos, designs, and apparel for different teams across sports. So thanks so much for taking the time and joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And just to do my due legal diligence, my opinions and anything that I say do not reflect those of Fanatics Inc. or my employers or any of the organizations that are discussed or represented herein.
Awesome. The Twitter byline. I appreciate that.
Yes, the very essential Twitter byline. Views are my own. Love that.
Exactly.
Awesome. So mentioned a couple of your stops. Obviously, I didn't touch on all of them, but I'd like to dive into and understand why design, how did you get into it? And why sports?
Yeah. It's really interesting. I was always, the why sports is way easier because I grew up being a sports nut. It was something I did watching sports with my dad as a little kid, like so many fathers and sons from time immemorial. But I was just obsessed with it. And I wanted to be a professional athlete. So my real kind of first noticing of sports aesthetics came from the uniform standpoint. So like, and from that standpoint, like I wanted to be a pro athlete. So I had to have the gear that the pro athletes wore. So I needed the official on-field hat and the official dugout jacket. I was a baseball kid, initially growing up. And I wanted the official jersey and the official pants. It's like if Barry Bonds or you know, JT Snow or any of the San Francisco Giants who were my team growing up, if they're not wearing it, I'm not wearing it. So, you know, that was just my attitude as a kid growing up. But in terms of like how I came to design, it was very much a winding, weaving road. It was not something that I really was cognizant of until I got into college. I was a performing arts kid. I was going to be a music major for a long time until I burned out on that in high school. My mom is an amateur artist. Both of her parents were professional artists. So it was like in the periphery of my cognizance. But and my dad is also in the promotional print product industry. He has been my whole life. So he has his own business that he's been running for almost 40 years now, selling printing and promotional products. So it's like the design world was always kind of like adjacent to me, but just like nothing that I was very conscientious about. when I got into college, back up a little bit first. So because I was obsessed with sports, I just loved it. I used to draw all my favorite team logos in sketch pads just for shits and giggles. And then I started making up my own teams, and my mom has this great home video of me making NBA jerseys with puffy paint on like blank tank tops that my dad got through his wholesale connections.
That's awesome.
So I would do stuff like that, and I was also really into hockey as a kid. So I had a street hockey mask that I made a team up for and painted my own goalie mask. So it was like there were those things that were always kind of there. And then when EA built in the created team modes and some of those mid-90s to late 90s games, that's when I really started going more into the making up the team logos and uniform thing. So it was always just kind of like a hobby I did for fun. And then getting back into college, I was in my dorm at the University of Oregon, and I was making a football team for a fantasy team on the sportslogos.net forums. And the light bulb went off, and I was like, oh, hey, this is a thing people do for like a job. I guess I could do that. Why not? So that was kind of how I arrived at the design part of it. But I still didn't put sports design and graphic design together until well after I had graduated. To me at that point, it was really just sports branding at the time. And I didn't think I had anywhere near the skill or experience to be able to come anywhere close to that. But being that I loved logos and identity design, I wanted to go into that. So I kind of aspired to land at one of the big branding agencies of the day, you know, Landor and Associates, Interbrand, Pentagram, Future Brand. A lot of them were, you know, insert adjective or verb brand at the time. So that's kind of where I focused, was just on like corporate identity design. And that's kind of how I got into it.
Well, I have to know, what type of performing arts? Was it like musical? Like, what was your, and how old were you then?
I did community theater as a kid. Mm-hmm. I think the first one I did, I was 5. And then I got really, I was in an all boys chorus from the time I was 8 until I was 14. So mostly singing, but also theater. I did musical theater in high school. So
that's awesome. And does that like translate into your job at all? And the reason I ask is because I just had this conversation with my manager about like my behavior in meetings versus when I'm like in front of an audience or presenting in front of people. And he's like, there's a little bit of a difference. Like, he's like, you turn it on in some instances, but not others. Like, do you feel like you apply some of that like performing arts into your work now in any way?
Sort of. I mean, I guess I am always in meetings looking to make people laugh or kind of just bring some levity to the situation. I wasn't a class clown per se, but I always was looking to make a joke. Mm-hmm. I think more than anything, it's really just given me the ability to have the confidence to go and do even something like this, just to speak to people I don't know. And have confidence in doing that without the fear of like, oh, what am I going to say? What am I going to do with my hands? Like, you know, the mm-hmm. the Ricky Bobby thing that I don't know what to do with my hands. That thing, like, I don't have any of that. I don't have that fear. Like, I can go, somebody could say like, hey, would you be a speaker at a conference? And tomorrow I'd be like, yeah, I'll get on a plane and I'll come talk. What do you want me to talk about? And mm-hmm. I can also improvise really, really well. So I don't do a whole lot of preparation in terms of like, interviewing for jobs or conducting interviews for people I'm hiring. I can really do a lot of that on the fly just based off of all of that. But, you know, having the confidence to reach out and network, and it's not something that has ever really intimidated me. And I think that's been a big part of why I've been successful in my career.
I'm curious. And for those listening, Brian is rocking an NHL jersey right now, a Ducks jersey. And I'd like to hear more about like your day-to-day work and your current role with Fanatics. Like, walk us through a day in the life, maybe, you know, this week, like what have you got on your plate, job-wise?
I would love to share what I do on a day-to-day basis, but NDAs are pretty tight. So I'll speak a little bit more generally. So my job at Fanatics, I have a very poor title, in my opinion. It doesn't really articulate what I actually do very well. So I'm in charge of designing any and every logo that goes on an NHL jersey, along with the name and number typefaces that go with it. So it's my job to oversee the creation or execution of those, whether we're designing them in-house or we're getting them from our member club partners, or there's a collaboration there between. So that's really what I do. I'm making logos and name and number fonts for NHL jerseys.
What would you say is, you know, and obviously speak as broadly as you need to here, but what would you say is like the biggest challenge that comes along with that? Because that's definitely a different, like, corner of design in the sports world we haven't really spoken too much, right? I think we talk a lot about, you know, video and graphics with that and general, like, general design, social media design, but what's a unique challenge that presents itself in that space that's different from something you've worked on before?
Well, I mean, for me, it's not really different. It's kind of the same challenge. It's the same thing. It's identity design and sports branding. Which I've been fortunate enough to do in my career prior to joining Fanatics. So speaking to that, I think the challenge with sports branding in general is just the sheer amount of investment that everybody has with it, be they ownership, leadership, creative team, internally, the fans. I mean, this stuff gets a lot of eyeballs. So there's a lot of pressure to get it right. And I think, you know, the potential landmines include things like not giving the fans what they're demanding, but sometimes the fans may want something that the organization isn't all that interested in pursuing. So, you know, it's really a lot of threading very, very small windows with very fine needles. It's very easy to get wrong. It's difficult to get right, to make sure you're striking that balance of being respectful to the brand if you're doing an evolution and, you know, doing something that will pay homage to the history without just repeating it, if that's kind of the brief of the brand, or if you're doing something totally new, having good rationale and concept for the why behind it and making sure that that gets communicated. I've always found, I think, the biggest hurdle is really just the communication part of like why we as creatives are making the choices we're making. We don't generally tend to make choices in a vacuum. I think there's fans who are very quick to say, why did they do this? Why did they do that? And generally the answer is we'd tell you if we could, but a lot of times we can't because of NDAs. The lawyers will have us for breakfast if we do that. honestly, like, again, like, we're not making choices just for, you know, because or for fun. Like, we have thought and rationale behind it all. And if that gets communicated properly, or communicated, if I can actually use English properly, then I think it's more successful. Like, the better storytelling that whoever is launching the brand does, the better.
So you talk about that kind of pressure in the eyeballs. What does and obviously generically speaking here, where does your like feedback and approval come from? And what's that chain like? Is it other creatives, or do you have to sell it to an executive level sometimes and kind of like what you said, explain the choices you made and what's that general process like?
I'm not going to touch on how the process works at Fanatics, just to keep my toes in line there. Unfortunately, I can't really speak to any of the specifics of all that stuff. But when I'm doing it on my own independently, the level of interaction and approvals kind of varies team by team and org by org. I've had it where I've been dealing directly with ownership. I've had it where I've been dealing with executive leadership. I've dealt with underlings under the executive leadership. So it just runs the gamut. Ultimately, there is at some point an executive decision maker, whoever that is on that, or it can be sometimes a decision-making committee. But generally speaking, like, I try and present those ideas. I've set it up where I try to make my presentation decks ones where I don't have to be in the room to explain my creative choices. So I have a lot of reference imagery in my presentations. I have a lot of expository writing that goes along with them, just because, you know, I can't be everywhere all at once. So I try really hard to make sure that the design choices are very, very clear, especially in the later rounds when we're making like iterative changes. Like, I do a lot of like option one, option two, option three, option four, like all on the same page, so that, you know, people making decisions on those minute little details can really see the differentiation. And even if it's like even more minor than that, I'll like overlay things on top of it. Just again, because I'm not always going to be in the room when this stuff gets shared, just due to schedules or, you know, politics or bureaucracy, however it gets structured. So I don't know if that answers your question or not.
That does. And that's really interesting, because it's like you have the actual designs themselves, mm-hmm. but you are also designing the pitch decks, so to speak, which is a completely different form of communicating. So it's kind of like very, very meta. You mentioned, you know, you might have like four iterations mm-hmm. of a project. Is there like a sweet spot number that you found, like, okay, there's five for this project, or there's three for this one? Like, what's the science behind that? Or is there not?
There is no science. It's the branding is one of the hardest things to get right. It's really subjective. It's really personal. Then the people get really, really invested on it. Specifically with team brands, there's so many different applications as well. There's digital space, social, animation, motion, in-venue, large format signage, you know, stadium graphics. There's the uniform. There's merchandise. There's giveaway and promotional items. So there's so many different little things that have to get touched. It's not simple. So when I'm actually putting out proposals and quotes, I usually don't include a cap on revisions or concepts. Sometimes you get it right the first time. Sometimes you get it on concept two. Sometimes it takes you a year and you're in concept number 325. So
wow,
I don't like to cap that. Because the other thing too is like, what constitutes a revision? If I change, you know, the shape of an eyebrow slightly, is that a revision? If I change the color of this element from green to blue, is that a revision? Like, how significant of those changes do we get into it? And especially when you're writing a contract that gets, and you're trying to build in that like limitation of that, it gets really tricky to kind of nail down those specifics. And that's oftentimes when I was first starting out, one of the things that I would get the most pushback on were late fees and revision fees. So it's like, all right, this is just not conducive. And then from a psychological standpoint too, if you tell somebody you're going to pay $10,000 for this piece of design work, just as an easy round number. And you're going to get, you know, five concepts and two rounds of revisions, and there's your 10 grand and you can itemize it however you want. They're going to see those five concepts and their two rounds of revisions, because that's what they're paying for. What happens if you get it right on concept three and revision number one? You have to do extra work to justify their fee. So if you take that out of the mix, that's another piece where it's like, we're not under pressure of how much time do we have left in the project? How many revisions do we have left? Well, you only delivered four concepts. You said you were going to give us six concepts. It's like, yeah, but there's only four good ones. I don't want to throw two shitty ones in there because, you know, we agreed on six. Consequently, like, I'm going to show you 19 concepts and you're only paying for five. So I'm kind of screwing myself out of this, but you need 19 concepts to get the look right. So it's, you know, it works both ways. So I've kind of just figured I'll pad my pricing a little bit to kind of account for that and get around that whole landmine.
Very interesting. I don't think I've ever heard an approach like that. I like it. It makes sense. I mean, the way you broke it down, because I feel like that's it, and it part of it too is like, for me at least, how much the client understands the creative process, right? And the client could be a variety of people, right? That's I like that approach.
It simplifies the conversation too, because like that allows you flexibility to be able to kind of just talk to them and say, listen, we're getting to the point where this is out of scope, or like, hey, yeah, we can toss this in, or we can change things because it's a flat fee and it's kind of covering all of this. I generally tend to make my fees scope specific. So like, this is a set number of deliverables and it costs this. But in that, you get all the files, you get all the final artwork, you get all of the concepts, all the revisions, it's all built in, and it's one easy price that we don't really need to kind of haggle over. And then if they do, like, you know, gosh, you quoted us 10 grand for this project, we really can only afford 8. Can we do that? Yeah, we can make that work.
You touched a little bit on being freelance, and obviously you spent what, 7 or 8 years before coming to Fanatics as a freelancer.
Mm-hmm.
Can you touch a little bit on, you talked a little bit about who you work with and how the process has worked through your freelance work.
Sure.
Can you talk about how you got clients as a freelancer and how you approached, you know, you started out talking about how you felt comfortable reaching out to people, making contacts and talking through, any of that kind of stuff to earn business. Can you talk a little bit about that side of it?
Yeah. I've been very lucky that I've had a very non-traditional way of getting clients, because I haven't had to go knock on doors or cold call or reach out by email. I've really been able to leverage my website, some social media, and then really just my network. And a lot of that stems from my time working in-house in sports creative at the Arizona Diamondbacks. My relationship with my former boss, John Welly, there, when he left to go to the Miami Dolphins, that got me connected with several people who led to other projects because of their connection to John and his connection to me, which facilitated a lot of stuff, which then led to a lot of other stuff, which led to other stuff, which led to other stuff. And it's a really interesting breadcrumb trail that I can tie a lot of that success back to the D-backs and my time there. In terms of like starting the business, that's another interesting story that I can get into. But in terms of like just having clients, every time I was in-house, I always tried to take on freelance, just because builds out your creative range and satisfaction. And if ever you do want to build a business, it's a lot easier if you already have clients to go off of. So I can't remember like how some of those very first clients found me. I think it was just like dribble trolling or on my very crude 2007-08 website. but I did have a couple of very small minor clients. I mean, I did maybe $5,000 in freelance a year back then. And it was just a little drips and drabs here that I would do like on the side while I was working in-house. When I eventually left the University of Washington and moved back to Oregon right before our daughter was born, I had been lining up a role with Adidas, and it never panned out. And so I was unemployed, and my wife was going on maternity leave, which was unpaid. So that's when I reached out to those few clients that I did have, and I said, hey, I don't have a gig right now. So I have time. If you have any additional work you need done, you know, if you can throw anything my way, I'd really appreciate it. So the couple of clients that I had while I was working for UW and the D-backs did. They threw me some extra projects, which was great. And then I also reached out to John at the Dolphins, and I said, hey, man, I don't have anything that I'm doing right now. If you guys need help, give me a shout. And they threw me a ton of work back then before they hired Brandon Moore in-house. So that was really what got the ball rolling, was me just at that point, reaching out to those few existing freelance clients and saying, I've got time. Do you have work?
The power of the pen.
Yeah.
Or the keyboard in today's day and age.
I actually called these people on the phone, which I know for Gen Z can be scarier. And some of my fellow millennials is less than comfortable. But yeah, I actually called them because that was the etiquette of the time.
Yeah. Do you make calls? That's an interesting thing. Like, do you make as many calls now, or is it truly like email? Text?
I do far less on the phone, much more so over either FaceTime, Zoom, or Teams now. I think the video conferencing boom that happened in COVID has really facilitated that to be much more frequent use of you know, connecting outside of text messaging, which I prefer because I think, you know, seeing somebody's face or hearing their voice as you're talking to them and hearing intonation, like, it just lends itself better to a productive conversation, where text message can be a little bit, you know, it's safer, but at the same time, you know, you also get none of the emotional or tone inflection in that, which can kind of tell you thing. Like, there's a difference between reading the words, yeah, we can find something, versus, yeah, we can find something, or yeah, we can find something. Like, all three of those have very different connotations in how they come across. So I like that, but I definitely, especially the people I've worked with a lot over the years, it's generally just a text message. It's almost like a, hey, you up kind of a thing.
Love that. That's amazing. I'm curious, like, throughout your career and even now, you know, you're very established and you've got your design practices kind of like what seems like down to an art of sorts. How do you continue to build your skill set and to grow in your craft even today? And how did you early on in your career?
Yeah, and imposter syndrome is a really great motivator. So I went to the University of Oregon at the time, and I think now still they don't have a true graphic design degree program. So I consider myself to be almost entirely self-taught when it comes to principles of graphic design, or taught from some very helpful mentors along the way early on in my career. But for me, it's recognizing that I'm not the greatest designer out there. I'm not the best logo designer. I'm not the best, you know, social media graphic designer. Surrounding myself with people who are ridiculously talented is one of the ways that I do that. My partners in Zero-G, Sam Silverman, Brandon Moore, Ashley McCaffrey, and Dan Beltran to a degree, they're all phenomenally talented. And the fact that I get to actually sit at a table with them and call myself, a partner of theirs is, it's really cool, because there's stuff that I bring to the table. No doubt about that. Like, I recognize that I have value to the group, but man, those, in certain circumstances, in a lot of circumstances, those guys can and gals can design circles around me. And so I just try and soak up what they're doing. And I ask a lot of questions, you know, how did you do that? Why did you make that choice? How did you get to this thing? I've been working with my senior designer, Jeremy Nelson, for a year and a half now at Fanatics. And I have yet to meet a better technician when it comes to logo design and type design than him. And just looking at his art files and the level of precision in his curves and his Bezier corners and his anchor handles in Illustrator, like, blew my mind. I thought I was good. And Jeremy made me realize that I had to step my game up. And so that's it for me. It's like just never getting complacent. Like, I don't want to ever get to the point where I'm sitting on the mountain. Because that's the fastest way you fall off, is thinking you're at the peak, when realistically It's not a mountain. It's just a never ending ladder that you can always continue to get better in some aspect. And so that's how I kind of approach it. It's just knowing that there's always going to be someone more talented. There's always going to be somebody who has a fresher idea. So, you know, what can I do to simply learn from those people, not even necessarily compete with them? And that's another thing too. I try not to look at this as a competition. It's not, you know, me versus, you know, Brandon doing logo design. Like, we can help each other out. We're colleagues. Like, there's plenty of work to go around in the industry. There's plenty of amazingly skilled, talented people. I've gotten to know and work with a lot of them over the years. And so it's like, what can I do to help other people as much as help myself? Because I believe that all that comes around. Call it karma, call it destiny, call it fate, call it, you know, whatever you want to call it. I've just found that, you know, the more positive things you put out into the atmosphere, the more it comes back to you.
Amen to that. We're all shaking our heads. Y'all can't see it, but we're all like, mm-hmm, yep, agreed.
So you've talked a little bit about your process and how you approach things, the design, the details, and all of that. I'm curious, when it comes to actual apparel design, how can you make sure that what you're doing, I'm assuming you're working digitally, but how can you assume that working digitally, how does that transfer to fabric? And are there any like pitfalls that you have to look out for or anything like that?
Put it this way, and this is what I'm going to dance around a little bit. There are ridiculously talented people who have way more experience on that than me, who have told me what to do, and I listen to them. I think that's really, I mean, listen to the people who know what they're doing is what I would say.
Yeah, totally fair.
That's great advice. I feel like it's hard for some of us sometimes to be like, no, like I'm in charge of my art, you know, like not like, and what you said earlier really resonates. Like, we don't operate in a vacuum, but I feel like sometimes there's a mentality that creatives have that it's like, you should be like the solo writer in a dark room by yourself, you know, not speaking or, you know, talking to anybody else. But I feel like you just put it so bluntly. It's like, work with others and work with the people that have, you know, kind of done it before.
I mean, if somebody knows how to make a widget better than you, like, you can draw the widget. That's great. Like, you go to the widget maker and you go, I'd like to make this widget. And they're going to say, okay, well, we can do this, but we need to change this, this, and this for this, this, and this reason. Your answer to that should always be, you got it. We can make those changes. Or if you don't understand that, it's okay to ask why. There's nothing wrong with asking why. But it should never come from a place, I think, of like intimidation or hostility, because, you know, then it is, it's that, it's my design versus your execution. Like, again, like, we're all trying to get to the same end goal here, which is like the best product we can put out there. So if you know something that's going to affect the way that my art is made, then I should consider that as part of my, it's no different than a client saying, like, you know, make this piece of the logo 15% bigger. Why? Because I like it better. You're writing the check. You got it. And it's my job to take that feedback and polish the turd, so to speak, and to do with it the best that I can to make the design piece of it fit the brief from the client as best as I can, because that's the job. You know, we're not creating art, we're creating design. Design is a service. Design is created for others at the pleasure of others. It's not, art is for the self. Art is self-expressive. So that's a big kind of line in the sand that I have, that I always, like, anytime I'm feeling with that, that's like the self reminder for me. It's like, it's not my art. It's what the client wants, the team wants, what has to get out there has to fit a certain set of requirements. It has to set a certain brief. It has to fulfill that And to accomplish that, I'm going to make these choices within that box, and I'm going to explain my reasons. And then when there's pushback, I'm either going to accept those changes and then create the best version of that that I can, or provide alternatives that accomplish that goal in a different way. But it's ultimately up to the decision maker to choose the final execution. It's not up to me.
I love how intentionality has come through all of it, because if everyone understands what the end goal is and understands why something can happen or can't happen, or understands the reasons behind the designs that are being created, it has more impact, but it also has more usability, right? Like, the in order for it to happen, it has to be this way. So
yeah, I mean, you know, you'll get a, I've got a lot of times where I've had a client be like, I don't like how thick these lines are. It's like, okay, well, print that out at an inch and a half tall. Now tell me how the lines right. are that thin. You can't see them. Your logo disappears. Or put that logo on a dark background that's not the same color as those lines, but it's you know, similar enough in hue and value. And then that's going to fade into them. And now tell me you still don't like those thick lines. You tell me you still don't like those thick lines after looking at that? Okay, that's up to you. But here's why I made those lines that way for these reasons. And a lot of times it comes down to education and communication. So yeah, that wins out. You don't win every one of them. You're not going to win every one because it's subjective at the end of the day.
Right. Yeah. You talked about it earlier. People have emotional attachment to brands, right? One way or the other. There's things like, even at my company, you know, we're not, our brand isn't a heavy focus of our sales or, you know, company effort, but it's still, you know, parts of the brands are very emotional to me. And if we were to change it, right, I wouldn't want to change certain things. Right. And that's totally subjective, right? 100% subjective. But I like what you said about the intentionality, right? Because we talked about it when I would supervise young editors, right? They, you know, I'd ask them, why'd you make this cut here? Why'd you do this? And sometimes they'd be like, I don't know, or I thought it looked cool. It's like, that's not a reason, right? That can't 100%. Be a reason, right? You have to have motivation behind everything you do, whether it's video editing or cinematography or design, right? Because then you can explain it. Like you said, you can put it out and you can lay it out in a brief and you can say, this is why we did this. People can disagree with why you did that, right? But if somebody asks you, why'd you make these lines this thick, right? You give them the reason.
Yeah.
Your answer can't be like, oh, I thought it looked cool, you know?
Yeah. Because
then you're being subjective too, right?
Absolutely.
In a way that, you know, isn't helpful to getting to the end goal.
No, for sure. And I think the other thing that it can do too is it can spur conversation. Like, okay, I understand, like, this is what you're trying to do with it. My perspective is slightly different. Can we achieve that in a different way? And that can help spur the revision process so much more too, as long as you're communicating that. Or they can say,
I don't prioritize that the way you do, right? You know, and it's like, here's what I'm prioritizing ahead of that. And that's an easier conversation because that's not criticism anymore, right? That is an order of operations of how they want things prioritized, right?
Exactly.
As much as you can objectify the subjectivity, I think is huge.
And that influences the revisions, that influences the creative, because once you understand where your client or where the decision maker's mind is at, like what they're trying to achieve, the faster you can get under that understanding, the easier the execution on the creative is going to be.
You also mentioned a brief earlier, like in your freelance, in your process, you talked about a brief. Because of all the intentionality and understanding all of this, do you spend a lot of time up front with these clients in order to make sure that you have as much understanding as possible for direction and what they're trying to achieve before you even get into Illustrator or
absolutely
or, you know, like a pencil to paper or anything?
Yes, 100%. When I'm working independently, I always really try to establish the concept direction first. It's so much easier to derive creative from a concept, and making sure that everybody is on the same page with those concept directions is crucial. You know, there's teams that have come to me and said, hey, we want, like, it's new ownership, new leadership. We want something brand new. Great. Totally cool. We can do that. Or we're a new team. We've never had a brand before. Like, where are we going to go? So it's like, well, what's your team name? What's your location? What are those things? How do those things work together? So what can we pick out of those things to say, like, to represent the team? Like, there's bucket A, like, you know, a team called the Mariners, for example, not the baseball Mariners in Seattle. You could go with sailors. You could go with fishermen. You could go with an aquatic animal to represent the sea and therefore the life of a mariner. You could do netting. You could do a ship's wheel. You could do sails. You could do a modern steamship. There's all these different kinds of things. And then, like, what, depending on where the team is, like, if it's in Hartford, Connecticut, like, you know, that's a Civil War town, like, and a revolutionary town. So do you lean hard into the Civil War? Do you lean hard into the Revolutionary War from a you know, graphic language perspective? Do you lean into, like, modern commercial fishing? You know, like, if it's in Boston, like, do you lean into the harbor? Do you lean into, you know, Massachusetts? Like, there's all those different lanes you could potentially go down. And if you don't get on the same page with the client at the very, very beginning, you're going to spend a lot more time spinning your wheels in the mud going nowhere, because they have likely had some ideas in their mind of what it should be. And if you're not communicating that, you're going to spend a lot of time kind of butting heads. What doing that all up front allows for is for you to say, like, hey, this is where we could go with these things. And all of that, for me, is based in research. Like, it's not, again, just pulling things out of my rear end. It's all research based. So that's the first thing I do from my research. I try to pull out those buckets. And then it's, you know, hey, client, like, here's everything I found. What are you connecting with? And sometimes there's, like, we had this idea up front. That's it. Like, you can chuck everything else. That's our bucket. There's other times where they're like, oh, we had no idea. Like, that's a thing? That's a thing here? We never knew that. That's really cool. Let's do that. Or sometimes it's like, we like these three, these four, these five. Like, all of them are connecting for us. We'd love to explore everything. Without having that kind of shared thinking up front, it makes it really hard to kind of hit something that lands that the team is also equally excited about.
Speaking of excitement, what gets you most excited about the design process? Is it final delivery? Is it iterating? Like, what sparked your joy the most throughout the process?
For me, it's seeing the finished product out in the wild. I still geek out over seeing stuff that I've designed out in the universe, whether that's on TV or you know, walking around Disney World or Universal Studios, I'll see people wearing a San Diego Padres hat, and I'll be like, I made that. I did that. That's
so cool.
I just, like, hop up and down kidney candy store kind of a thing. So, like, every time there's something out there that I've designed that I see out in the wild, the more obscure too, like, the more fun it is. But just seeing that stuff, I just absolutely, like, blows my mind.
Where's the most unique place that you've seen your work?
Probably, I saw a Hillsborough Hops t-shirt in Disney World a few years ago before I lived here, which was really, really interesting, because they're a low level minor league baseball team. So I was like, hey, like, Hillsborough Hops. And they're like, yeah, you know them? I'm like, yeah. So awesome. That was fun. I want to say I saw, like, a Padres or a Kraken something or other in Paris, at Disney Paris, when I was there. So, but I mean, I could be making that up for all I know. so yeah, definitely the theme parks. I see a lot of stuff that I've designed over the years.
And you mentioned, you know, before the call, we were kind of chatting before we pressed record, we were talking about family and, you know, what do you do outside of your design life? Like, what are some of the things that you do outside of work, or different hobbies, things like that?
Yeah, I work a lot. I just, between doing freelancing and then the full-time job with Fanatics, I work a lot. So any free time that I get, I try to spend with my family. I'm very lucky. My wife and I bought a house with my folks in Oregon back in 2017. We all moved to Orlando together in 2021. So I get to see my parents every day, which is really nice. My dad works from home. My mom doesn't work. My wife doesn't work. Our daughter is in virtual school. So I get to be home every day with my family all day, every day. And I'm so grateful for that. But like actually going and spending time with them when I'm not working is generally what I like to do. Love going to the theme parks with them, love traveling with them. And I think the one like off the wall thing, I have been learning French for 4 years, and that's probably the only other thing that I've been spending my time doing.
Ah, that's cool. I know like one phrase, and it's je suis fatigué. I'm tired.
Oh, yes, you're tired.
What inspired learning a new language?
J'ai visité la France il y a 4 ans. No, we took a trip to Paris back in December of 2021. Il y a 3 ans. So I started learning a year ahead of that trip. Like my dad and I surprised it as a Christmas gift in 2020 for my wife, my mom, and our daughter. So that was our 2020 Christmas present, was 2021 in Paris in December. Mm-hmm. And so in November of 20, I started picking up because I wanted to at least be like able to get very basic directions while we were there. And sure. I got decent at it, and I just have kept up with it. Fanatics has we work with SP Apparel in Quebec. And they speak French up there. So it was like, well, comes in handy in Quebec, though Quebec French and French are different.
Right.
And then, you know, I loved Paris. I loved visiting France. So I would love to go back. And I just find language fascinating. I've always found it fascinating. I took Latin in middle school and my freshman year of high school. I learned Spanish after that. So I'm something of a polyglot. I've had little bits of Italian, a little bit of German, a little bit of Japanese here and there. I find language to be absolutely fascinating. The way etymology, you know, transforms language and communication. I'm a dork.
I love it. No, I don't know. We got in our society, I feel like the word dork and nerd is like seen as like such a negative. And I remember my brother when I was younger, he was like, if you date people, like, I want you to be with a nerd. And like, I was like, that is the weirdest thing you've ever said. But it makes sense, right? Like, I feel like there's a lifelong learning that you have. And it seems like, you know, it's carried you throughout your career and obviously mm-hmm. a very successful one. And I feel like, you know, some of the things that you said earlier about like, you're not on a mountain, you're on like a never ending ladder is such a great example for doing the work that we do, because not only is our industry always evolving, but we are also evolving mm-hmm. ourselves in the craft. So all that to say, I love that you're a dork. It's awesome.
Thank you. You know, it works for my wife too. And that'll do for me.
Happy wife, happy life. That's the line I've heard.
Amen. And there is all the truth. Happy, happy wife, happy daughter, happy life.
I love that. I love that.
Yeah.
I have a feeling the latter is a little bit more challenging than the former, but who knows?
We do all right. We've made it to 9 decently enough.
Yeah. Nice. I wanted to ask you about being freelance and having your business for 7 to 8 years and then going and working internally mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. maybe some lessons that you've learned from your time being freelance and how that applied to your current role, partially because I feel like now that I've been freelance for a couple of years, I feel like I'd be much better working internally just because of the business knowledge and, you know, how to collaborate with other people and different people all the time, as opposed to just the same people consistently. I'd love to hear your thoughts and feelings on how that transition has gone and what you've learned and brought with you.
Yeah, I think you nailed it on the head. I was not looking for a full-time in-house role when the gig popped up with Fanatics. It's right place, right time, right job. You know, I don't know that I would have jumped for just anything. Like, this role is really unique and special, and they only come around so often. So that was the compelling factor for me. But yeah, I think you nailed it, Justin, that, you know, really working with the volume of organizations that I've worked with over the past decade has really made it a lot easier to kind of understand how other departments operate, how different organizations operate, and then organizations within organizations, and just understanding a little bit more of like how business operates, just from running not one but two businesses. And then watching my dad run his business for my whole life. Like, it's definitely made it a lot easier when you know, the bean counters and the operations people and the suits come around and they say, this has to be this way for this reason. A lot of my response is, okay. You know, I found my own like internal like frustration levels to be a lot less because of that. Like, just, it's just like dealing with any external client, and I treat it as such. So it's a lot easier to kind of deal with the headaches and kind of trials and tribulations. You know, it also helps that I'm 38. And you know, my first in-house role, I was 24, 23. Mm-hmm. The maturity level and just like the world experience you get between 14 years is pretty intense. So, you know, it's a lot easier to be calm, rational, and just let a lot more slide off your back. It's also really a lot easier to look at the benefits of the full-time gig, the steady paycheck, the benefits, the, you know, the environment, like
health insurance.
Health insurance is a big one, but even just like the workflow, like I can turn Fanatics off at 5 o'clock in the afternoon and not think twice about it because it's set up to function that way. Right. Where, you know, when you're independent, like any minute you're not working, you're not making money, you're not providing for your family. So that level of stress and that urgency of you know, bringing home the income and supporting the family is gone because I don't have to worry about that. You know, that's not to say that things don't go sideways. Like, you know, they could hear this interview and be like, bye, Brian. I don't think that's going to happen, but you never know. Like, the world is a fickle, finicky place. So it's a lot easier to just like accept things for the way that they are and roll with it because, you know that you can build something or you're continuing something on the other side of it. That's the other comfort. Like, I can definitely say, like, if things go sideways, I can feel comfortable in my own skin and not have to panic and stress about what's next. That being said, for anyone from Fanatics listening, I love my job and I'm very happy.
I love that. I mean, listen, I think a lot of that resonates, and we've had Justin and I and Brock and Darius on this pod have had many conversations about, you know, freelance versus in-house. You know, myself, I'm working, you know, full-time with the company. I've never gone fully freelance. So all of that makes sense. But I think, it's interesting just what you said about being at a certain age. And I'm curious, the growth that you mentioned, if you could go back in time to your younger 23, 24 year old self, is there anything that you would tell them about to do differently or to lean into more? Is there anything that's kind of top of mind for you when you look back?
You know, I want to go back to one thing to the last question before I answer this one, because I do have thoughts. But I think the other thing that's really interesting, the in-house role, like, I do one job. I'm responsible mm-hmm. for one thing. Mm-hmm. And that's much simpler. You know, yep. all, like going back to what you were talking about from a production standpoint, like my developer needs something a certain way. Yeah, you got it. You tell me what you need and I'll give it to you. My boss asks for something. Yes, sir. You got it. I'm on it. Like, I'm a cog in the wheel. I'm not the wheel, the cog, the mechanic, and the salesman, which on an independent side is kind of exciting and fun to a degree. But it also means that you're spending equal amount of time not doing the creative work that we got into this industry to do as you're doing the creative work. So you're wearing, you're independently, you're the CEO, the CFO, the CMO, and the creative director, and the art director, and the production artist, and the intern, and the temp, all in the same day. So, you know, it's tough, but the flip side of that, I could do this all day. The flip side of that is, like, you can set your own hours. You could, I could have gone to Disney Attitude. I could take client calls from Epcot and be like, oh, hey, yeah, I'm not in front of my computer right now, but yeah, we can talk about this logo I'm designing for you. Like, that was really nice to be able to just be like, nah, I don't feel like working today. I'll work on Saturday instead.
Right. The, like, flexibility associated.
Oh my gosh. Idea. Yeah. Show up at, you know, I get to the computer at 11 o'clock, quit at 4 on some days. Some days it's 7 a.m. to midnight. Like, there's trade-offs, and they are really true trade-offs. Yes. I'm 9 to 5 for Fanatics Monday to Friday, but you know, I'm also 9 to 5 Monday to Friday.
Right.
Like, so, like, yeah, I could go all day back and forth between those. So
it's funny that you said that, because the first time that my wife and I went to Disney, we went at the end of August, and I didn't realize that was like the time where people started, like, September, October, like in the sports motion world that I work in, where with boards and the start of all that stuff seems to be the time that everybody, like, reaches out. So I was in Disney going, oh man, did we pick the wrong time to come down, down here, because everybody started reaching out around that time. So
it's funny. It is it's all trade-offs. But so to answer your follow-up question, Karina, like, I think I'm not big on regrets. Like, I think for me to go back and talk to my younger self and say, hey, you should do this differently, is I would consider a mistake. Because if I didn't do things the way that I did them, if I didn't fall into the traps and pitfalls and make the mistakes, have the successes that I had, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you right now. I wouldn't be living in Orlando. I wouldn't be married to my wife with my daughter. I wouldn't be working for Fanatics, working on all the amazing things that I've gotten to work on and will continue to get to work on with them. Like, none of that would have happened had I not made the exact choices and had the same circumstances happen to me. So, you know, would I tell myself, hey, maybe, like, don't be such a firebrand and, like, just take a fucking chill pill and relax a little bit more? Yeah, but at the same time, you know, like, 38-year-old me offering people advice would definitely be like, yeah, just relax. It's just design. You're not curing cancer. Like, it's cool. But I also think about that, like, no, you should be that passionate. You should be that the uppity, persnickety asshole. You should be the one pushing the envelope at 24. That's one, that's the time to do it. And two, like, the people that just sit back and let life happen to them are the ones who don't create an impact. And I think people get into design because they're passionate, because they want to make some kind of an impact on the world. And just because we do that aesthetically does not mean that it's not valuable or impactful or meaningful. So, yeah, like, go be the upstart. Go be who you are. Like, fly your flag and don't shy away from it. So, yeah, I don't know. That's always one I've wrestled with in terms of, like, what advice would you, like, don't run your mouth off so much, maybe. But at the same time, like, if you didn't run your mouth off, you wouldn't feel comfortable expressing yourself now. So it's like, it is also trade-offs.
Right. I love it. No, it's true. I look back. I think it's even just a good message for like, even me now, right? It's like, we're always trying to like self-help and self-improve, but like there is something to be said about who you are is who you are. And that's, you're given those skills for a reason. You're given those traits for a reason, you know, yeah. Just like lean into where you are now. Yeah. I think is a great message for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I guess really the one thing I would say is like, just take an extra beat before you say something. Make sure that you've thought it all the way through.
That is excellent life advice, even outside the workplace. Let's be real.
Yes. Yes.
I have one curious question for you. What's your take on generative AI?
Oh, I think it's a scourge. I think it's an absolute scourge. I fundamentally hate it. One, it's not actually artificial intelligence. It's really just an automatic mimic of what's there. I think the training that it's been, you know, trained upon is copyright infringement and plagiarism, and so it's not actually generating things that are original. I think the actual quality of the output is horrendous. I think the people that are at the corporate ladders who are looking to utilize it are trying to cut corners to get creative for a song, and I think that's going to blow up in their face. But I also look at it very much in the same vein that I looked at like NFTs. I think it's something that is going to, or Canva, I think, is a better metaphor here, because people, you know, Canva came out and people in the creative industry panicked and were like, oh my God, they're coming for our jobs. Yeah, they've always been coming for our jobs. They don't want to pay us because they don't like paying for skilled workers or people who have creativity.
Business is a spreadsheet that scales.
Exactly.
Creative to be, and creative cannot be right. That.
Right. And that's a fundamental misunderstanding of people who are not creative on how creative works. Like, to be able to be in a position where you have to output creative all day, every day is mentally exhausting. And if they could peek inside our brains for a minute, they would go, oh, good God, I'll go back to marketing. And please don't ever bother me ever again with that. Like, they would be just absolutely, you know, in abject horror looking inside of what we have to deal with inside our minds, that is. So I think, again, like, going back to the Canva example is a great one, because the like, people in the creative industry were like, oh my God, they're coming for our jobs. And that didn't happen, because at the end of the day, it's limited. There's only so much it can do. It can't replace actual creative people, because creative people come up with things that non-creative people can't. And Canva is a great tool to get people to leave you alone. So I've always been team Canva. Like, if you want to have me create templates for you in Canva, hell yeah, fuck yeah, let's go. Like, you got it. I will make you Canva templates all day, because that means after I've made those templates for you, you are going to leave me alone. And I'm going to do the cooler stuff that you're not going to bother me about. And I think generative AI is going to be similar in that vein. I think designers and actual creative people may use it as a shortcut tool for prototyping or concepting, which I see no problem with, provided it's not the final creative
deliverable.
And I've seen a few commercial spots where that's happened. And I've seen some creative out there, and it's just awful. And I think the people that are trying to position that as like the new solution to replace creative talent are going to be short-lived in their roles for that. So I would say to all of my fellow creatives and designers and artists out there, keep pushing against generative AI, because it needs to be reined in, and we need to make sure that it doesn't overtake us. But I also think that if anybody pushes back against it, it won't happen.
See, I've been scared about using it for legal purposes, 100% for clients. I even had a client once ask me to use something that was, I don't know if you guys have heard of Beeple. He's a motion designer that makes a 3D motion designer. He did the Everydays that sold for what, $69 million for the NFTs, that huge sale.
Wow.
So
69 million.
Yeah. He built a whole studio and everything for showcasing. Look up Beeple. He's unbelievable. It's really cool.
I feel like you might have mentioned him before.
He has content available on his site that's royalty free. Like anybody can take it and use it. And I had a client ask me, or they sent me that, and were like, we want this. We want to use this. And I was like, well, that's not really my skill set. But B, I also don't really feel comfortable taking something that's royalty free and turning it around, and you're paying me for it. So even in that situation,
mm-hmm.
I guess that's kind of what AI feels like to me.
Oh yeah, 100%. I would never personally, I don't want to use it because I just think it's trash. But like the actual end results are trash. But getting into, the output's awful first and foremost, but yes, from a legality standpoint, it's, I don't know how it could not be ruled infringement. So until the USPTO or the Supreme Court or some US legal entity rules that it is not infringement, I'm going to steer clear of it entirely. At least personally. And even if they do say, no, it's not infringement, I'm still going to cast a sideways glance at it.
I feel like it's the ideal for workflow enhancements and not.
Yes.
Yeah. So like,
I agree with that. I am on team.
Probably not for what you do, Brian.
No, I get that. I mean, I think even the ChatGPT, like the writing piece of it, has almost jumped the shark. And now people are like calling out AI writing. So it's like, I guess the workflow optimization piece of it is, yeah, sure. I don't like, yeah. But I mean, is that really fundamentally different than like Siri or Alexa, which are essentially AI models that we've had built into the iPhone since God knows when? And it's like, scheduling me a meeting, and it's like, okay, well, I guess in my field with what I do, like I don't have that need of being super scheduled that way. But then I also still use a pencil and notepad to write down my daily tasks. So, you know, take everything I say with a grain of salt.
we're all on the old end of all this stuff for sure.
Yeah.
I got my mechanical pencil that I'm waving right now.
Mechanical pencil for the win.
There's something about a pencil.
Hey, I got one too. Hold on a second.
Wait, really? Yeah. Yes. We're all literally waving our mechanical pencils right now. Listen, I do believe there's an AI fatigue currently happening. I think that's why, you know, I don't know if it's just like what I'm being fed on social media. I'm seeing more people wanting to get into crafting and like making things and painting and drawing and community classes on all of these things about how to like build with your hands. I do think, you know, there's a fatigue of sorts at play. And so I'm very curious how it's going to like impact the creative industry and how we work and operate.
I think that perfectly highlights what Brian was saying about Canva though. Like as people who create ourselves, we're not against the tools, but the tools might help us push people who want the low end or don't care about the quality or high maintenance clients or whatever that don't have the budget. That's a direction that you can push them. And then they say, well, actually, no, I want something higher quality. It's like, okay, great. Then I'll talk to you. Like, I feel like that's the gap that it's technically filling.
Yeah. 100%. I've seen a few reels on lately that were talking about AI, and it was like, I want AI to do the tasks for me so that I have the ability to go create, write poetry, make art, play music. I don't want AI making my music and my art and my literature so that all I'm left with are the dull, repetitive, robotic tasks. And I think that to me is the fundamental issue with AI in its current state at the moment. Let's automate the the boring shit and leave more time for the creative pursuits, for the worthwhile pursuits. Why are we the human mechanical automatons? So now we're getting real philosophical.
I love it. Question, Karina. I always like hearing people's perspectives on it, because I think, you know, on the team AI to I hate AI spectrum, everybody I think is in a different, you know, line, right? So I always love hearing everyone's perspective on it. The last question I will ask: Spotify Wrapped, everybody's been posting about it right now. So what has been like your version of Wrapped, like your top songs, number one, if you have them, your top projects, like that you've been most proud of? And maybe it doesn't even have to be within the last year, but like throughout your career.
Sure. Well, let's start with the Wrapped. I mean, it's going to be a really, really interesting one because my daughter is on my Spotify. She's got some weird stuff
love
on there.
It.
I heard my kids listening. I had Pandora and they have it on the iPad, and I heard them listen to stuff. I'm like, they got good taste. This is awesome. And then I was like, wait a second.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. So my top song was Dance Monkey by The Tones and I, which my daughter in fact introduced me to, it wasn't Kids Bop, but it was some like meow pop mix or something weird that she came across it for. Yeah. So Dance Monkey by The Tones and I was my top song of 2024. She's a good tune. I like it. It's a bop. But in terms of like projects for this year, stuff that hasn't come out yet, which is going to come out, some stuff has come out, like working on the Anaheim Ducks rebrand for Fanatics was amazing. Mm-hmm. That was my first project with the brand. It was like the first thing I got in the door, and they were like, okay, here's your first project, Anaheim Ducks rebrand. I'm like, I know that we were going to be doing this, but like out the gate, okay, let's go.
And that's your team, right? Like for NHL or just...
No, I mean, I don't really have teams anymore. I've been doing this long enough where I've worked with teams I've rooted for. I've worked with rivals. I was employed by the University of Washington, which is University of Oregon's biggest rival. So it's like,
right.
I don't do the whole team. Like I root for my clients and I root for the brands that I work on. So, I mean, I'm wearing an Anaheim Ducks jersey because I did the logo. So I'm just excited that I get to wear my portfolio. It's dorky, but I love it.
That's gotta be the tease from this. How many people could say that they wear their
jersey? Yeah, that's next level, man.
In a cool way.
Yeah.
Flex.
I have here in my office, I don't know if I'll be able to get my monitor around the corner here, but I have, I have this rack over here, and these are all, so down here in the corner, these are things that I've gotten from previous jobs or clients, but all up here, this is all stuff I've designed.
Y'all, he's got a whole like clothing rack with hats and jerseys. This is, flex on them right now.
And go meet any, what am I wearing today?
Yeah, it's a lot of fun to be able to do that and just, you know, rock out, you know, out and about in you know, and they'll say, oh yeah, you know, I love the jersey, and I'm like, yeah, I designed the logo, and they're like, what? and then you know, I look the way that I look, and people are like, no, you didn't. I'm like, no, I swear to God, I actually did. Like, so I always pull up my website of like, this is my driver's license. This is my website. So, you know, I'm not lying.
That's so cool.
But yeah, so Anaheim Ducks is definitely one. Working on the Winter Classic was incredible. Ooh. Working on Four Nations Face Off, also very, very cool getting to do that. I worked on the Team USA and Team Finland uniforms. Lots more coming up very soon. Bruins centennial anniversary jersey that they wore over this past weekend against the Canadiens. That was a cool one to get to work on. It's the full-time gig is really, really awesome. But on the non-Fanatic stuff, like my other company, Zero G, we did a project with Stanford University this past year, and that was really cool to work on. They're an amazing group of people out there in Palo Alto. Great folks, great brief. They were so awesome to work with, and I think the results are great quality. And that was a really fun one to work on.
I have one last question. Maybe it'll be the last. I feel like I've said that the last three questions. You mentioned they had a great brief. What makes a great brief, in your opinion?
There's not like one thing that makes it a great brief. I think it's really just something that clearly outlines the goals of the project, whatever that may be. Like whatever we're trying to achieve, I don't think you necessarily need to have the specifics of the deliverables or like the specific design points within the brief. If anything, that can be a little limiting. But just knowing like, this is the end goal. This is what we're trying to do. This is what we're trying to accomplish. If that can be articulated in any way, shape, or form, I think that's what makes a successful brief.
So much good stuff. So much good insight. I feel like we could talk for hours on end about all this stuff.
I mean, I enjoy gabbing about this stuff. I don't get to do it often enough. Oh, I'm here by myself, isolated in Orlando all day, every day. So, it's, you know, other people, hooray!
Yep.
Well, thank you so much for making Creative Sports Podcast part of your day. Special thanks to APM for providing the music used in the podcast today. We'd love to hear your thoughts, feedback, and suggestions, so pop on over to the Sports Creative Community on Slack and connect with us and your fellow creatives. If you're not a member and would like to join, go to sportscreativeslack.com and sign up for free. Remember, the world needs your voice, so keep creating.